Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another edition of CMC Radio. I'm your host, Rob May. Hope everybody's having a great weekend so far. And thanks for joining us now, early on a Sunday morning. We're hoping that you guys are, you know, enjoying the weekend. And we got some nice weather here on the East Coast. Very excited to have on the show today, Ms. Sarah Molino. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be with you.
Now, Sarah, where are you calling from this morning?
I'm calling from Greensboro, North Carolina.
Greensboro, very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what time? What's the weather like down by you right now? Just curious.
It's 42 degrees, so
whoa.
It's a little bit chilly out, but it's sunny and beautiful, and it's supposed to get up much warmer. And this is typical weather for North Carolina, that it starts out cold in the morning, and then by the middle
gotcha.
Of the day, you have to strip
nice.
Off your layers.
All right. Hey, that works, right? You don't mind. It's better than having to bundle up throughout the day.
Right. Exactly.
So, Sarah, why don't you, just to get right into it, tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, where you're from. Have you always been from Greensboro? You know, just fill us in.
Okay. I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri. And my parents were, my mother is still alive, my 95-year-old mother. My father was a son of European immigrants, and my mother was a second generation, a third generation American. We are from a Jewish family. And my father grew up in Worcester, Mass., my mother in Omaha, Nebraska, and so she was familiar with the Midwest, and my father saw that, my father was a lawyer and saw living in the Midwest as an opportunity to get out of his, get the ghetto where he grew up and find a new place for himself. So they were sort of pioneer. He was a pioneer and very, very concerned about raising his children as Americans. And he thought that because his parents were immigrants and he would be an American and his children would be Americans, that we would all understand each other better. But unfortunately, he got four children raised who grew up in the 60s. So then he thought he didn't understand us at all. So being Jewish is a key part of my identity, and also coming from this family that was very concerned to be upwardly mobile in some ways. My father really wanted to make enough money to support the family because that was what he was raised to do. And my mother was very active in community activities. She volunteered in all sorts of things. And she was involved in the civil rights movement in Kansas City. She was chairman of the Human Relations Committee, involved in desegregation. So a lot of political conversation went on at the dinner table and at the breakfast table at my house.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how did that kind of influence you?
Well, I always felt that I needed to read the news and that I needed to be aware of what was happening politically. And since I grew up in the 60s, I was very much concerned I was very moved by all that was happening. I was moved by the civil rights movement, by the anti-war movement, and you know, by the time I was in college, we were in Vietnam. So, so those three, and then in the early 70s, I learned about the women's movement. I was living in New York. I was already married. I was married at 22. And we were very involved in the politics of the time. My husband at that time was in a graduate student at Columbia, and then taught at Columbia during, he was a graduate student in 1968 when there was a big demonstration on the Columbia campus, and some of his professors were, you know, were beaten by the police, and Friends of Arts occupied the building. We didn't do that, but we were certainly very engaged in the student movement as well as the anti-war movement and the women's movement.
Sure. So you really grew up in the heart of all of that. I mean, that was a controversial time,
and,
obviously, for a lot of different people.
Right, and that growing up at that historical moment, during which time, you know, in 1968, Martin Luther King was killed, and Robert Kennedy was killed, and I have a friend, a colleague, who did a course once on 1968 and all the things that happened in 1968. So.
Oh, yeah.
So we were highly grew up in a family that was a very political family, as did my husband. And so these events and this social context very much influenced who I became as an adult.
Absolutely. Now, where did you say that you actually studied then?
I was an undergraduate at Wellesley College in Wellesley, Mass. Actually, in the same residence hall with Hillary Clinton, and so I knew her as a 19-year-old, and which was fascinating, which has been fascinating to me.
Sure.
And I was as an undergraduate, I studied philosophy. Because I didn't really know what I was doing, and that was a small department, and it was nice. But I was also very interested in history, and eventually I figured out that history was really more appropriate for me. I was more interested in concrete events, and philosophy was too theoretical, but I was grateful for the style of argumentation that I learned as a philosopher, and that's certainly useful as an academic and as a historian as well.
So then
I did my graduate work at Columbia.
Very impressive. Not too bad.
Thank you.
What did you do with your background then, as far as your educational background? I mean, it's pretty impressive, like I said. So where'd you go from there?
Well, it took me a while. It took me a while to decide that what I really wanted to do was to go to graduate school in history. I was first, when we were first married and living in New York, I taught in a high school for what they called at the time underachievers, which meant kids who couldn't function in the normal public school setting. And so it was a therapeutic school, and I taught history and philosophy. So from that experience, I taught there for 2 years. From that experience, I realized I didn't want to teach high school, that there was too much time spent on disciplining. And at that time, I was also reading and, you know, influenced also by current events and what was happening in New York at the time. I was reading some materials about U.S. history. And I had, as a senior in college, a wonderful course by a man who is still an active professional that was called Social and Intellectual History of the U.S. And he used a lot of art to talk about that time period. And he also taught us the very earliest literature that was beginning to come out about slavery. And so that was, you know, as the civil rights movement was happening, and as I began to learn about the experience of slavery and also about some things about the 19th century, about abolitionists, I realized that I wanted to go to graduate school in U.S. history. It didn't happen for a few years because we had an opportunity to spend a year in Israel and a year in England. Before that, but then when we came back and I had my first child as a daughter, I realized that what I really wanted to do was go to graduate school in American history, and really what I wanted to do was to study Black history. But it was at a political moment when it was not okay for white people to study to do Black history. And so I found my way into another way into studying Black history, which was to do women's history, which could open up the doors to understanding multiple cultures. And I made a particular effort to understand the Black experience through looking at women's experience. So I ended up with a dissertation on working women in because I really wanted to understand, you know, another issue of that time was really looking at class structure. So I wanted to understand the class structure, and I also wanted to understand the ethnicity. I wanted to understand what provided upward mobility for working women, and so that's what I did.
That's, you know, and again, now, what was your experience like doing that? I mean, again, you lived through a time where you saw a lot.
Yeah, we were living outside of New York, so I was commuting into New York, and I had this little daughter, and so I was making an effort to do my graduate work by going to the having a babysitter and going to the library, where I did some sort of daycare arrangement for my daughter, and going to the library, and then going into Columbia, a few days a week when I had classes. And my husband at that time was teaching at Columbia. He was a little bit ahead of me in terms of his professional career. He was working on a degree in philosophy, and he also was studying to become a rabbi. Nobody does anything simply in this family. So he was doing two schools at once. He thought rabbinical school wouldn't be that hard. And so, you know, so he could do both at once. But in fact, that didn't turn out to be the case. And so he did a couple years in rabbinical school and then concentrated on his philosophy degree. And that's what took us abroad. He had an opportunity to study in Oxford. He won a fellowship. And so he spent a year in Oxford. And then we met there some wonderful Israelis. And the husband of this couple taught at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem and realized that Jonathan knew some Hebrew. Jonathan is my ex-husband now. But anyway, knew some Hebrew and could teach in the Hebrew University. So he said, maybe next year you'll come to Israel. So Jonathan thought that was a great idea, and we both thought it was a great idea. And so we had the opportunity to live in Israel in 1971, which is, you know, not that long after the Six-Day War, and made some very good friends there, and so developed a deep connection with Israel, which was important especially to him. And during that time, I became pregnant with my daughter, and then when I came back, I decided I wanted to go to graduate school. So I was 27 or something like that by the time I started graduate school, and it took me about 9 years to finish my degree, because I then, after I took my orals, I had a second child, who was 4 years younger than his sister, and then we moved to North Carolina. So I was commuting. I spent a summer in Boston, a month maybe, in Boston living with one of my sisters, and doing research in the Schlesinger Library there. I went to Philadelphia, did research there, and I was having to travel around to get the sources that I needed for my dissertation. But eventually, with a lot of hard work, it got done.
Right. I'm sure. I mean, you know, it sounds like the amount of work that you had to put in, I mean, it's a lot.
Yeah, well, writing a history dissertation is meant to be a book. And
right.
So I was the first person at Columbia to actually do a dissertation in women's history. And so you know, I knew how to dig for it because it was already mm-hmm. A field, and I knew what kinds of sources to look for. And I also had a wonderful colleague who was also writing about the same subject. What I wrote about were department store women in between 1870 and 1920, mm-hmm. and there were lots and lots of sources. And this friend of mine, and this is about feminist collaborative scholarship, was also working on a similar topic. She had a different approach. But what we did was meet each other in the basement of Harvard Business School Library, which was one of the places where they kept some of the newspapers that these department stores produced, and we shared sources. And so she gave me her stuff, and I gave her my stuff. And so we were able to, double our sources of information by sharing, and it was a wonderful experience, and it also taught me about collaborative research and collaborative, and it was a very much a feminist approach that you don't, that you assist your colleagues and that you collaborate with them, and you don't, and you encourage them rather than criticizing them, which was the general style of academics at that time. You know, it still is a style of academics in other fields, and it was very much the style. My husband is a philosopher. Of course, the important thing was to win the argument, and so it was very different, and this is part of what appealed to me about doing women's history from the beginning.
Sure, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Now, what mm-hmm. was it in dealing with and working at Guilford's college's Women, Gender, mm-hmm. and Sexual Studies program, what was it mm-hmm. about that you found to be the most rewarding aspects of doing it?
Oh, it was wonderful. I mean, it was really a key piece of what I love to do at Guilford. Guilford is a small 4-year liberal arts college, and it's run by Quakers. So mm-hmm. Everything that happens there happens by consensus, and it follows strict Quaker business procedure, and mm-hmm. and it also has a kind of religious overtone in which people in faculty meetings, for example, which are run by Quaker procedure, they faculty are encouraged to speak their minds, and they're encouraged to listen to other members of the faculty in order to try to get a consensus of the meeting. A sense of the meeting is what they call it. Anyway, so the women, when I first came here, and we came here as my husband was on a job interview for the philosophy department, and I just came along because they said, you come too. Because you both have to decide on whether or not you want to live in Greensboro, North Carolina, which was a completely alien place to both of us. And so we came here, and the person who was in charge of taking me around and showing me Greensboro was the woman who founded the Women, Gender, and Sexuality program at Guilford, and they had gotten a grant in 1974, which is really early for the development of women's studies programs, and they had developed a strategy to introduce women and gender studies, women's studies, into the curriculum at large. So they used a technique that they called mainstreaming, and they knew, the people on the Guilford campus knew that no one had studied women in graduate school. So I was the first person who had any kind of professional training in women's studies, even though the people I worked with didn't know much, but they knew they knew enough to know what I was doing. And there wasn't all that much literature in women's history at the time. Now there are tons of journals and journal articles, and there's one huge conference that it happens every every 3 years that now has thousands of scholars that go to it, but it was very small to begin with. Anyway, when I came to Guilford, I was immediately I was lucky to be hired, first of all. My husband got the job, and I was here working on my dissertation, taking care of my kids, and trying to figure out how to do it all. And I had to travel to get these sources. And so so they gave me a couple of courses to teach part-time. And my dissertation advisor said to me, don't do that. You got to finish your dissertation, and when there's a full-time job, then you'll apply for it. And fortunately, there was a full-time job that came up when a couple of years after we moved here in the history department, and I was lucky enough to get it. So I wasn't quite done with my dissertation, but I was thrilled to have a full-time tenure-track job. And the Women and Gender Studies program was something that attracted me tremendously, and it was something that was very important to the older faculty who were themselves working to think about how to integrate women and gender studies into the curriculum. And so they immediately solicited me to teach a course on women's history, which I did for the first time in 1981. And so I started in 79. So it was just shortly after I was hired. And I became very involved with the program and developing the program. And one of the things that they used to do, because nobody knew very much about this subject, was that they used to have study groups, and they invited any scholar of women's history who would come to Guilford for very little money and educate people. So there was always a kind of intellectual environment in which we were working across disciplines but sharing with each other what we knew and what we understood and developing new insights together. So it was a very intellectually exciting program to be a part of. And the woman who founded it was amazingly creative, and a lot of people were drawn to it. And Quakers also have a tradition of equality in ways that other religious groups do not. Women could be ministers. There was a separate men's meeting for business and a women's meeting for business, and women were what they called elders, and so they would mentor other younger people in the meeting and so on. And so these people who were part of that early interdisciplinary program, and that's one of the other things that was new about it, was that it was very highly interdisciplinary, were very committed to equality between men and women, partly because they were Quakers, but partly because they were children of the 60s and so equality was part of what we all thought about. So I worked on that program from the very beginning, worked with that program from the very beginning of my time at Guilford. My department would never allow me to teach a full year course in women's studies. They said one semester is enough. And so I picked and chose which things I would include, and then I also taught a course on women in economics with somebody from the economics department. I teen taught a course on what was called women, race, and with an African American scholar. She was actually an African scholar who had taught herself African American history, and we taught it twice. And that was a wonderful experience. So I found ways in my ordinary history classes to incorporate the study of women. And I, told them up front that's who I was and that's what I was going to do. So much of the history textbooks now have changed tremendously since I started, and they now make an effort to incorporate the study of women. But at that time, American history textbooks were organized by presidencies and wars and bringing the ordinary experience of the ordinary person and bringing women into the picture, merely 50% of the population, it was a big effort. And so that's the narrative that I wanted to create with, particularly in my women's studies and my women's history classes. But I also taught a course, I was a social historian, so I taught a course called Social History and Social Memory, and so I incorporated, you know, some books on women into everything.
Sure.
So I made sure that my students had an understanding of a more complex view of U.S. history.
Now, how did you, and again, Sarah, you know, unfortunately, we're already down to the last 4 minutes of today's show. I'd love to have you come back on so we could get, you know, more into it. But I'm curious to know, as far as your students go, what was your students' reaction to all of this that you were, you know, teaching?
Well, the students' reaction was generally pretty, they were intrigued. Some of them were annoyed by it and would be critical of me about it. They, you know, but the college environment was such that it was being, that they were being taught to think in an interdisciplinary way. There were always interdisciplinary requirements at the first year level and at the senior level. And so, and they were also children of the 60s. So, you know, their parents were children of the 60s. So, they were kind of hippie types early on, and then by the 80s they got to be more business types. But they played along with me. You know, I tried to create an open classroom where every student could feel safe and could ask any question, because I knew that some of the material I would deal with would be provocative to them on a personal level, and so I wanted them to feel free to speak. So it was fun to do that.
I can imagine. I mean, I remember, you know, for even myself, back in college, those were the classes that you remember, the ones that kind of provoked kind of controversial thought, you could say. And you certainly take the most away from a class like that. It's not like you're falling asleep, you know, trying to learn numbers.
Well, I didn't let them.
Like,
I mean, fortunately, the classes were small. They were maximum 25 students. And I often had smaller classes to begin with the in women's history. And so I insisted that we have a discussion class. And I did, you know, some lecturing always, you know, from time to time, but I really wanted them to talk, because part of the thinking of the strategy of the college was that active learning is really crucial. And so I always insisted that they lead discussions from time to time, and that they actively participated, and part of their grade was based on participation.
Absolutely. And Sarah, as we're winding down now to the final about a minute and a half, just curious, real quick, if you could tell us, you know, what for you is the most rewarding aspect of your career?
Well, I love my students. I really love my students. And because many of them were from North Carolina, I learned a great deal from them. And also, Guilford has a population of adult students as well as a traditional age students, about half and half. And so they had a lot to teach me, and I was very grateful for that. And I had wonderful colleagues. You know, they were all, there was an environment of sharing ideas and of intellectual stimulation. And they were kind. They were, you know, because they were Quakers, they were not in the kind of fray where I had been in New York. In New York, it was being a feminist was controversial, and you know the media made fun of feminists, and people argued very intensely. But when I came to Guilford, it was much more inclusive, and so you didn't matter what political decision you took. It was just simply working together, and because they were trying to bring women into the curriculum, they had to take people where they were in terms of their own attitudes towards gender equality.
Sure. Well, Sarah, again, I appreciate you coming on the show this morning, and we
Thank
hope to
you
get
so
you back
much.
On to continue this conversation a little more.
Lovely. That's lovely. Thank you.
Again, thank you, everybody, for listening, and you were listening to CMC Radio, and today we featured Sarah Molino. Sarah, have a great rest of the weekend, and again, like I said, I hope
we'll
hear from you soon.
Thank you. Okay, I appreciate that very much. Okay.
And thanks. From everybody here at CMC Radio, we want to thank you guys again for listening. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks.